The following live presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
We're going to do a little discussion today about Rosh Hashanah. I want to read you an incredible piece that I picked up. It was in the Jerusalem Post like years ago. And every few years I come across it in my, you know, files, whatever. And this is just so appropriate for this day in terms of what we're studying. But I think in general for where we're at, where we could be, sitting and learning Torah in the old city of Jerusalem, right? A time comes, this is called awakening. The author's unknown. A time comes in your life when you finally get it. When in the midst of all your fears and insanity, you stop dead in your tracks, and somewhere, the voice inside your head cries out, enough. Enough fighting and crying or struggling to hold on. And like a child quieting down after a blind tantrum, your sobs begin to subside, you shudder once or twice, you blink back your tears, and through a mantle of wet lashes, you begin to look at the world through new eyes. This is your awakening. You come to terms with the fact that he is not Prince Charming and you are not Cinderella or vice versa. And that in the real world there aren't always fairy tale endings or beginnings for that matter. And that any guarantee of happily ever after must begin with you. And in the process, a sense of serenity is born of acceptance. You stop complaining and blaming other people for the things they did to you or didn't do for you. And you learn that the only thing you can really count on is the unexpected. You learn that people don't always say what they mean, or mean what they say, and that not everyone will always be there for you, and that it's not always about you. And so you learn to stand on your own and take care of yourself. And in the process, a sense of safety and security is born of self-reliance. You stop judging and pointing fingers, and you begin to accept people as they are, and to overlook their shortcomings and human frailties, and in the process, a sense of peace and contentment is born of forgiveness. You learn that it is truly in giving that we receive, and that there is power and glory to creating and contributing. You learn that you don't know everything, it's not your job to save the world, and that you can't teach a pig to sing. I'm skipping here. You learn that anything worth achieving is worth working for, and that wishing for something to happen is different from working toward making it happen. And you learn that life isn't always fair, you don't always get what you think you deserve, and that sometimes bad things happen to unsuspecting good people. And on these occasions, you learn not to personalize things. You learn that God, Hashem, isn't punishing you or failing to answer your prayers. It's just life happening. And you learn to deal with evil in its most primal state, the ego. You learn that negative feelings such as anger and envy and resentment must be understood and redirected, or they will suffocate the life out of you and poison the universe that surrounds you. You learn to admit when you are wrong and to build bridges instead of walls. You learn to be thankful and to take comfort in many of the simple things we take for granted, things that millions of people upon the earth can only dream about. A full refrigerator, clean running water, a soft warm bed, a long hot shower. Slowly you begin to take responsibility for yourself by yourself. And you make yourself a promise to never betray yourself and to never ever settle for less than your heart's desire. You hang a wind chime outside your window so that you can listen to the wind. And you make it a point to keep smiling, to keep trusting, and to stay open to every wonderful possibility. And finally, with courage in your heart and with God by your side, you take a stand. You take a deep breath and you begin to design the life that you want to live as best you can. That to me encapsulates the month of Elul. Okay? The journey. Because most people think that a journey is something that we get placed into. And on one level, that's true. We're given a certain path. We're given different skill sets. We're given different experiences. Some of us more challenging, some of us less challenging. And at the same time, it's not true. And over the next couple of days, we're going to get to explore, I hope, Bezrat Hashem, right? Just how I can change, right? The car that I took a ride in to the car that I'm driving. And it begins absolutely with Rosh Hashanah. I remember we had one of the periods that I was in the army, we had a battalion commander who was a shtickle mashuga. He was a real character. His name was Shabam, Shimon ben Maimon. They called him Shabam, acronym. And he was absolutely mad. He was nuts. In fact, when the battalion went into Lebanon, right, so they hit at a certain point the Awali River. And one of the challenges at this point was we knew that there were certain shallow points, but we didn't know exactly where they were. The maps weren't clear, right? And there were heavy positions on the other side of the river, and so the unit was under fire, right? So all the tanks halted at the river because they had to figure out where they'd cross. Now, you can take a tank into water, you can make preparations so that you can go, but, you know, if the water's too deep and you marked it wrong, you know, it is a tank. It's 52 tons. It's not going to float, right? So you really have to know where you're crossing. Never mind if you hit rocks in the middle of the river. You don't want to find out in the middle of the river in tanks, which can't go more than a kilometer or two an hour, which is slower than parking speed crossing a river. You don't want to find out in the middle of the river that you've taken the wrong crossing point. Okay? So all the tanks are stalled. And Shimon ben Maimon Shabam on the radio starts screaming, "Nu, kadima, 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 bagalachem, kadima! What's the matter with you? Yada!" Right? So nobody right knows what to do. You know, is this the right crossing? Is that the right crossing? They don't have a clear. Finally gets fed up. Okay? Jump, you know, anyway in the Israeli army, we don't, you know, the Russians have a closed hatch doctrine, which kind of makes sense on a certain level. You close your hatch, you're inside your tank, you can see out your turrets, right? And that's how you do combat. It's kind of healthier when bullets are flying around, right? The Israelis, for whatever the reason, we don't do that, okay? We stand outside of the turret. Okay? It's actually easier to fight that way because you can see better. It's a little more challenging in terms of being targets, et cetera, right? Okay, each side has its pros and cons, right? So he jumps off his tank, passes the tanks in front of him, walks into the river, all alone, with a machine gun over his back, right? Completely ignoring the bullets flying around him, and just, you know, like with this fed up sort of, you know, look, goes, right? And just starts walking across the river. The Syrians on the other side of the river must have thought this guy was absolutely nuts. And somehow, he just wades through the river. It's very clear when he's walking up to his waist, right, that the tanks can follow along. Now, if you're a company commander and your battalion commander, right, that's like your god, is wading through the river in front of you, going like this, so so you follow along, right? That was Shabam, okay? He was nuts, right? But the men loved him, and they would follow him anywhere. And of all the distinct experiences that I recall with him, there is one that stands out in my mind, and that was Thursday nights. Thursday night in the Armored Corps is what's called Laila Levan, white nights, okay? What that means is you come back from the field. Generally speaking, on Wednesday night, you do all-night maneuvers, right? And in fact, when you're in certain training courses, you actually start from Tuesday morning. You're not allowed to sleep. It's supposed to train you for war, because the biggest challenge in war is actually the psychological impact of not being able to sleep, which is just the depression beyond description. And when you get to sort of Thursday afternoon, it's too dangerous to do maneuvers, because people are too tired. You know, your tanks banking into each other and stuff. So they always come back to base. And all night, Thursday night, you're fixing up the tanks. You know, you're what's called Tipul Shvui. It's a weekly thing. It's probably the most hated phenomenon in the Armored Corps. Like, if you can get out on Thursday afternoon, that's like better than, you know, going to heaven, right? Because you're missing this whole cleanup and grease the tanks or whatever, right? So there was another event that occurred in his battalion in the 195th on Thursday nights. That's what we used to call Mishpat Shabam. Mishpat Shabam meant Shabam court, okay? Now, what was a Shabam court? So, you know, at the end of the week, you have all these guys who've committed various infractions. The most serious of which, I mean, unless there are rare circumstances, God forbid, but, you know, normal events, usually the most serious infraction is that a guy goes AWOL, right? What we call nifkadu. Usually these are like, you know, the cook, or the assistant to the gunnery sergeant, or, you know, the guy who works in the armory. You know, you're not talking about your elite advanced commandos, right? If you're a cook and you're stuck in the kitchen, so every once in a while you can't take it anymore, they actually do a week in the army and a week out. That's how bad their life is, right? And you just kind of come back a few days late, right? So you're AWOL. So normally, after 24 hours, you're supposed to be reported to the military police, right? And they handle it. And, you know, if you're ruled AWOL, then they can put you in Mahbosh, in military, you know, either military guard or in prison for 2 weeks or a month or whatever it is, right? But not in Shabbam's battalion. In Shabbam's battalion, they have what's called Mishpat Shabbam. And basically what would happen is you get called in to the battalion commander's office, right? And the guys would kind of wait outside. You know, they'd be like, there's a courtyard in the center of the base. You could always pass by these guys. And they would always kind of look like, you know, I think somewhere between depression and sheer terror, right? And then eventually they would get called in, right? And you know, there's a whole system for when you get judged in a military tribunal, right? There's usually a three-man court, and you walk in, and you have to put your beret on just right, and you have to have your boots polished, and you walk in, you know, and you stand at this, fakir, you know, reporting for duty, fakir, whatever, this whole thing, right? And, you know, usually you do this, and they read out the charges, and you state your case, and they state their case. But in Shabbam's court, there was an additional piece. The additional piece says that before he would issue a verdict, he would ask the two other judges to leave the room, and he would stay alone with whoever the litigant was. At which point, the first thing that you would hear was this incredible roar, right? This yelling, and then you'd hear, boom, ow, boom, ow. And then this guy would walk out, and he'd have like a black eye, or he'd be like limping, whatever. And that was it, and then he got judged innocent. He didn't have time for military prisons. He didn't want guys sitting. He wanted them to go back to work. So he would basically beat the heck out of them. That's what he did, right? And I'll never forget the image of one particular cook. He was like this waif of a kid. He was 18 years old. He looked like he was 13. He was yay thin and yay short. And he had, for whatever the reason, done whatever he'd done. I wasn't quite sure. And he was standing outside, right, like this, kind of like not sure where to go, what to do. And all of a sudden, you know, they called him in, Nelson, right? And he looked like this, right? Din. Judgment. The sense that judgment is coming. Serious. If you've ever been in court, even in traffic court, when the judge is there and they call your case, it's like this intense feeling. It's not what you look forward to. Like nobody wakes up in the morning and says, yeah, going to court today. That's just not... So I guess the question in the back of my mind is, why do we start our year with what we call Yom Hadin, the Day of Judgment? That's such a heavy thing. Why is that the beginning? I mean, I would think that you have a Day of Judgment at the end of the year. You look back on your year, and you take stock of where you're at and what you've done, and I understand that you have to pay the piper, and I understand there are consequences. To begin the year with judgment, what is that about? And by the way, just to hone in on the point, if you're going to have Judgment Day, I mean, certainly in Christian, you know, liturgy, mythology, theology, Judgment Day is not the same as July 4th. It's not a party day. Okay? So this is an interesting question, which we're going to get into this afternoon when we talk about Yom Kippur. Would you say that Rosh Hashanah is a festival, or would you say it's something different? It's an interesting question. Now, we know that there are three festivals at which time you come up to the Temple Mount, and that's a big party. And we're going to get into this on Sunday. Okay? Not the party. Well, maybe the party, right? And they are Pesach, Shavuot, and Sukkot, those three festivals. Rosh Hashanah is not one of those festivals. And on the one hand, I can understand that Rosh Hashanah is not one of those festivals because it's Yom HaDin. It's the Day of Judgment. We blow the shofar, the clarion call to awareness, right? In fact, it's not the Day of Forgiveness. Yom Kippur, 10 days later, is the Day of Forgiveness, right? Yom Kippur is the day when we do tshuva, when we repent to some degree. Rosh Hashanah is the Day of Accounting. In fact, that's a very difficult question. I would have thought first we should repent, and then we're ready to do an accounting. But we do it the opposite way. So what is Rosh Hashanah? On the other hand, you know, there is actually a very simple way to ascertain whether something is a festival or not a festival. Very simple. Anyone want to take a guess? How do I define halachically, technically, legally, whether something is a festival? If I want to know if a day is a festival. Well, if you're allowed to do work, that's interesting. However, there are days, that would be one way to do it. There are days when we are allowed to do work and we still consider them a festival. You know, for example, the intermediate days of Sukkot. Okay, we go to work, we do work. Now, granted, there are certain limitations, but we do work, and yet they're clearly festivals. So that would work, but it doesn't quite work. There's a simpler way to do this. Hopefully, it's not high on your mindset because it means you haven't had much experience with it. No, it's really very simple. If, God forbid, you lose a loved one, so what happens after the funeral? You sit Shiva. Now, when you're sitting Shiva, this is the 7 days of mourning, okay, that we traditionally observe after the loss of a close loved one, a sibling, a child, a parent, right? So the festival actually breaks that week of mourning. Now, Shabbat doesn't break it. Whereas on Shabbat, you don't exhibit public mourning, but you go right back to sitting Shiva after Shabbat is over, and essentially, Shabbat is part of the Shiva. There are different customs that you have at home and private on a Shiva. However, the festival does. And we're going to talk about this afternoon, but if, for example, on Sukkot, okay, you lose a loved one on the eve of the festival of Sukkot, so you sit Shiva for a couple of hours, and then it stops. It's over, because the festival breaks it, right? You don't sit Shiva on Shabbos, but the Shiva continues in a different form. In other words, the rule on Shabbat, and again, I'm reminding everybody here, do not walk away from these little vignettes with halachic rulings. These are intense, complicated issues, so when you get to this point, God forbid, you know, you have to ask a question. But in fact, you don't sit Shiva, you don't display public mourning, which means you don't sit in a low chair, and you don't wear the same ripped clothing, you know, etc. But there are all sorts of forms of private mourning that you continue, okay, in terms of Shabbat. For example, if you're the chazan in your synagogue, if you're the you know, you wouldn't go up to the amud. You wouldn't go to lead the prayer services. You wouldn't wear a new suit that Shabbat. Even though, you know, during the 30 days of mourning, you could wear a new suit on Shabbat, right? Because you're still technically in Shiva. The Shiva isn't broken, it continues. If Friday was the first day, then Sunday is the third day. But if Friday is the first day and Sukkot is the second day, there is no third day. There's no second day. There's one day of Shiva. So that's a difference, right? Purim, for example, does not break a Shiva either. As a matter of fact, Rav Soloveitchik, when he lost his wife, I believe it was right before Purim, and he, based on the code of Jewish law and the Shulchan Aruch, he sat Shiva publicly on Purim. Because Purim is not a festival. It has a whole different energy to it. Right? So what about Rosh Hashanah? So I would have thought that Rosh Hashanah would also not be a festival, that it wouldn't break the Shiva because it's such a heavy day. But in fact, it is a festival. And it breaks the Shiva. And we make Kiddush on Rosh Hashanah. And we wear our finest clothing on Rosh Hashanah. And we're supposed to have a Sudat Mitzvah, a special meal, to celebrate Rosh Hashanah. All of which brings us back to the second question. What on earth am I celebrating? I mean, it's such a strange thing. And you know where you really see this? You see this in some of the prayers. I mean, we get to this on Yom Kippur, right? Avinu Malkeinu, right? Avinu Malkeinu Chatanu Lefanecha. This is very, very heavy. Our Father, our King, we have sinned before you or made mistakes before you. We have to pay the piper. And what do we do? I mean, what's the celebration? What do we do at the end of Avinu Malkeinu? You know that tune? Avinu Malkeinu Chaneinu Vaneinu. Do you know what that means? Do you know what we're singing there? Our Father, our King, we have no good merits, so please forgive us because we're lousy. It's such a strange thing to sing. I mean, what's the party on Rosh Hashanah? We're being judged, going to go to court. What is that about? So I want to understand that. So put that in one corner of your mind, and I want to study with you a Gemara. This is a very, very strange Gemara. I'm warning you in advance. Okay? So if you look at this box, okay, this box up here, okay, this is the Mishnah, and this is what we call the Gemara. Hence it says Gemara in Hebrew letters, okay? But basically, at a certain point in Jewish history, the Romans figured it out. They figured out that the secret to Jewish continuity is our Torah. And they figured out that the smartest way to finish that and to destroy every last vestige of Jewish independence, this was Hadrian, who we talked about on the tour, right? The easiest way to do that is to kill off the teachers, the rabbis. Now, you couldn't replace rabbis back then like you can today, because rabbis were a part of an unbroken chain from Moses, and in order to get smicha, to get ordination back then, it took almost a lifetime, right? So they started killing off the rabbis. Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, who was the greatest amongst them, realized that we were going to start losing our oral tradition. So he did what hadn't been done till then. How and why he did this is another discussion. And he wrote down pieces of the oral tradition, basically the basic building blocks, the heads of topics for discussion, so that we wouldn't forget what was in the oral tradition. And that was called the Mishnah. Okay? Basically a line of legal explanation for a much broader idea. Now that line, that Mishnah, that little paragraph, wouldn't help much if you didn't remember the entire discussion around it. He did this more or less around the year 200, okay, of the Common Era. It took about 100 years for people to realize this wasn't working. because we were in such a low level in terms of the exile that we were forgetting the discussions around them. So they started writing down the discussions. There was a fellow by the name of Rav Yochanan. In fact, in the Talmud, you can usually recognize the difference between somebody from the period of the Mishnah, which has much more authority being closer to Sinai, who was called a Tana, that's a teacher who lived in the time of the Mishnah, and somebody from a later period, the time of the Gemara, of the Talmud, who's called an Amora. One of the ways to recognize the difference is that the title Rebbe usually means that he came from the period of the Mishnah, he was a Tana, don't worry if you don't remember this, right? And and somebody from the period of the Gemara was called Rav. So for example, Rav Yochanan is not going to argue with Rebbe Meir, because Rebbe Meir was a Tana. He lived, 150 years before Rav Yochanan. Right? That'd be like me debating, the Chasam Sofer or the Chafetz Chaim or the Vilna Gaon. We're not really in the same league, right? So that's why you'll find in the Talmud that a Rav will bring a Rebbe as a support for his disagreement with another Rebbe. That's just to be aware of, right? So Rav Yochanan, who actually lived part of the time in Sipori, spent some time in Beit Shan, right? And also in Tveria. He began to edit those discussions, right? And that eventually became called the Jerusalem Talmud, the Talmud Yerushalmi. Okay, that was completed around the 3rd century, around the year 300, 330. It was very unedited. It was much more difficult. The community in Israel at that time, post-Hadrian, was not as organized. So there were two great rabbis by the name of Ravina and Ravashi. They lived in Babylon, and they realized that this still needed a lot of work. They edited the Jerusalem Talmud, they added to it, they took out pieces that they thought were incorrect, and they completed around the year circa 500 CE something called the Talmud Bavli. And that's what we today call the Gemara. Gemara means to learn. Gomar, he learned. Okay? Alright. So this is the Mishnah, and this is the Gemara. This is not the way a traditional page of Talmud looks. After you're learning, I'm going to bring back a Gemara so I can show you. Yeah, a Christian calendar. Common era. No. In terms of a general perspective, right, 1200 before the Common Era, which is about 1700 years earlier, supposedly when we got out of Egypt. And round about that time, some say 1300 BC, round about that time we got the Torah, the oral tradition, the written tradition of Sinai. And then you have a whole, the Jewish people get into the land of Israel. They have a couple of hundred years before they build the temple. 1000 before the Common Era, they build the temple under Solomon. Then they get kicked out. The temple gets destroyed. That's about 586 before the Common Era. Then they build the second temple. That's about 516 till about 480 before the Common Era. Then the second temple gets destroyed. That's 70 of the Common Era. Now we've passed the year zero in the Christian calendar, right? And now we're moving forward. Around the year 200, we don't have a temple anymore. We're losing our rabbis. They edit the mission and write it down. A fellow by the name of Rebbe Yehuda Anasi, Judah the Prince. That was done here in Israel. And then around the year 300 here in Israel and 500 in Babylon, we edited and came up with the Talmud. What's important about the Talmud, right, the Rambam Maimonides in his introduction to the Mishnah writes this. This is a very important point. After the period of the Mishnah and the Talmud, okay, we had a short period known as the Rabbanan Saburai, and then you have a period called the Gaonim. The Gaonim were the leaders of the Jewish community in Babylon. At this point, almost the entire Jewish world still lived in one place, in Babel. There was no Europe yet. There was almost nothing in Israel. There was, but not much. So basically, the mass of the Jewish people was in Babel. All right? And they started to realize, the Gaonim, that there were differences of opinion between the Jerusalem Talmud and the Babylonian Talmud. And they understood that if this continued, you would develop two Judaisms. So they fought and worked very hard to make sure that the Jewish people understood that wherever the Babylonian Talmud disagreed with the Jewish Jerusalem Talmud, that in fact it was the proper opinion, except for about four different cases. And they were such great leaders, they were so outstanding in terms of their scholarship, they were so accepted as the undisputed leadership of the Jewish people, that their word became law. And in fact, by, I would say, the 8th century, the Talmud was accepted by the entire Jewish people. Okay? The entire Jewish people. According to the Rambam, what's important about the Talmud, Maimonides, is that that's the last time that we had one book that was accepted by everybody. So even though we lost biblical ordination, because, they killed off the rabbis, we lost, like, I'm not biblically ordained. I didn't get smicha from somebody who got smicha, from somebody who got smicha, from somebody who got smicha, all the way back to Moses. We lost that. How we get it back is another question. But this became our smicha. Because this was the tradition written down by those rabbis and accepted by the entire Jewish people. That's what makes the Talmud so important. Okay? All right, so now we're going to have some fun. Let's look at this. Take a look at this Mishnah. This seems like a very sort of minute detail within the framework of Rosh Hashanah. But I want to show you why this is an example that can bring us into the depth, the essence of what Rosh Hashanah is all about. Okay? All right. So I'm just going to read this through and translate it so everybody knows what it is. And then I'm going to ask you to break up and have some fun and learn it and rip it apart and see what questions you have. And again, look around and see if there's someone who needs maybe a little assistance with the Hebrew, or you can feel free. Don't be embarrassed to ask, you know, if you have questions. Okay, so if you can't follow Hebrew and you can't read in Hebrew, do not worry. I'm going to translate, okay? Yom Tov Shel Rosh Hashanah Shechaliot B'Shabbat. We're on the top line. Okay, when Rosh Hashanah falls on Shabbat, B'Mikdash Hayu Tokin, in the Beit HaMikdash, in the temple, they would blow the shofar. Aval lo b'medina, but not in the rest of the country. Okay, they didn't blow outside. Now, we're going to have to figure out why. Mishacharav Beit HaMikdash, when the Beit HaMikdash was destroyed, Hitkin Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai, Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai, who was the head of the Sanhedrin, he was the head of the High Court, he ruled Shiyu Tokin b'chol makom sheyesh bo beitin. He said, even though beforehand we only blew in the temple, since we don't have a temple yet, we're going to blow everywhere that there's a beitin, everywhere that there's a court. Okay, there's another question. Amar Rabbi Elazar, lo Hitkin Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai ela b'yavni b'levad. Nope. Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai, this head of the Sanhedrin in the time of the destruction of the temple, he only meant that you could blow in Yavne. Now, Yavne was the seat of the Sanhedrin, so if in fact we accept Rabbi Elazar's opinion, that means you can only blow in front of a Sanhedrin. Okay, a Sanhedrin was the high court of 71 judges. Okay, in the time of the temple, it sat on this mount here. There were actually three Sanhedrins that sat on the temple mount. There was one large Sanhedrin, and there were two small Sanhedrins. A small Sanhedrin is 23 judges. By the way, what makes a Sanhedrin of 23 judges unique is that you can only sentence a person to death if, in fact, there are a minimum of 23 judges, right? A court of three cannot sentence a person to death, right? And they're fascinating halachot. I'll give you one example, because this will become important later. If a court known as a small Sanhedrin or a large Sanhedrin is judging a case of capital punishment, and they come to the conclusion that this person is worthy to die, and every single judge, okay, sentences him to death, all 23 judges agree, which would be incredible for 23 judges to agree, but if they did all agree that he should be sentenced to death, does anybody know how quickly the sentence would be carried out?
He doesn't die.
If all 23 judges agree that he should be sentenced to death, then he's not sentenced to death. Why? Because it can't be, says Judaism, that 23 judges could agree. So there must be that there's something that they're doing it too quickly, or that they're not looking at the material, right? It's just too impossible, and therefore, that's halacha. And there's a special verse, there's a special pasuk in Vayikra that deals with an interesting question. What if you're the 23rd judge? If you're the 23rd judge, and the previous 22 judges say he should be sentenced to death, and you know this guy is a serial killer, and you should sentence him to death, so what, you're a smart guy, you'll say, okay, if I say he's guilty, he's going to go free. So I'll say he's innocent, in order to make sure that he gets killed. There's a special pasuk that's written in the Torah, a verse specifically to that 23rd judge. You are not allowed to change your verdict. In order that he should be guilty, you have to judge according to the way your eyes see it.
So it's an open vote.
It's a very much open vote. Okay? No, we don't. But on the Temple Mount, if you're standing on the roof and you're looking at the Temple Mount, sorry if my back is to you, and the gold dome is over here, okay? That gold dome is where the temple itself actually was. To its right was a chamber known as the Ezrat Kohanim, where the Kohanim went, and where the external altar, the Mizbech Hitzon, was. Beyond that was a gate, all right, with steps leading up to it. That was called Shar Nicanor, the Nicanor Gate. And beyond that was an area called the Ezrat Nashim. Okay, literally the women's courtyard. Why it was called that is an interesting question. Men and women could go there, right? And men couldn't go, well, there was an Ezrat Gvarim, but it was very small, right? And in that courtyard, which is not quite opposite us, it's sort of over here, there was in the far side a building that housed the Sanhedrin itself, and it had its own chamber and actually had its own gate. And then inside the courtyard were two 23-member Sanhedrins. And they would judge cases before they went to the upper Sanhedrin. Okay? And all three of those Sanhedrins at a certain point in the Second Temple disbanded themselves. because they felt that the Torah wasn't being taken seriously, and that people weren't paying attention to judgment, and that murder was rampant and other things, and therefore they disbanded themselves rather than have courts sitting. Okay? All right. So, Amar Rabbi Lazar lo hitkin Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai l'Yavne b'Yavne. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai only said this about the court in Yavne. Okay, Yavne, by the way, is along the coastal region, very near Ashkelon. Okay? Which is in the news today, if you heard the news. Amrulo, echad Yavne ve'echad kol makom sheyesh bo beit din. They said, no. Any place, Yavne, or any place that has a beit din, that has a court. Ve'od zot, hayta Yerushalayim yetera al Yavne. Not only that, but Yerushalayim was still greater than Yavne. Shekol ir shehi ro'a v'shomat k'chova v'chola lavot tokin. Because any part of the city that could see, okay, now there's a big debate whether it means to see Jerusalem, or it's talking about in Jerusalem to see the Temple Mount, but if you could see, right, then you could blow shofar on Shabbat. Uviyavne Allah you took in Elab Beitin Bivad, but in Yavne you couldn't blow unless you were in front of a court. So just to summarize, if Rosh Hashanah falls on Shabbat, okay, so because it's Shabbat, you can't blow shofar. That's what it says. Okay? But if you're in the Beit HaMikdash, if you're in the temple, then you can blow the shofar. Okay? And Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai, after the temple was destroyed, said, well, you can blow shofar in front of a court. And then there's debate what kind of court. Only the court of Yavne, which is the Sanhedrin, or any court. Right? And that's an interesting question. And then there's a question of whether Jerusalem is different. The idea that if you're in Yerushalayim and you can see the temple, or if you're outside of Yerushalayim, you can see Yerushalayim, which probably means see the temple, that you can then blow on Shabbat. This is all very strange. But okay. Alright? Then, well, we'll just do the Gemara. Minaha ne'mile, okay? From where do I know this? From where do I know that in fact you don't blow shofar on Shabbat? Amar Rabbi Levi bar Lachma, Levi the son of Lachma, which means the bread. I guess he was a baker. Amar Rabbi Chama bar Chanina, right? He said it in the name of Rabbi Chama, who said it in the name of Chanina, right? Katu v'chad omer, in one place, in the verse, it says, Shabbaton zichron trua. And another verse says, Yom Chua, it's a day of blowing. The first verse says, it's Shabbaton Zichron Trua, it's a day when you remember blowing. I'm going to give you this pasuk in a minute, okay? Right? And the other one says, it's a day of blowing the shofar. So how come in one set place it says, it's a day when you remember the shofar, and in the other place it says, it's a day you blow the shofar? Lo kashya, no problem. Kan b'yomtov shechal liyot b'shabbat, because here, it's on a day when the festival falls on Shabbat. V'kan b'yomtov shechal liyot b'chol, and here it's when the festival falls on a weekday. Amar Rava, so Rava says, wait a second, if you're learning this from a verse, that means that biblically you're not allowed to blow the shofar on Shabbat. Rava says, imi doraita, if it's from the Torah, b'miktash hechi takinan, then how can you blow in the temple? I mentioned this the other day. In the temple, rabbinic decrees were not in force. But biblical degrees certainly were. You couldn't light a fire in the temple on Shabbat. Right? So he says, nope, this is not a biblical decree. The Od, and not only that, halav malachahi, blowing a shofar is not a malacha. Why can't I blow a shofar on Shabbat? Is it labor? Is it one of the 39 categories of labor that I do on Shabbat? It's not like lighting a fire, it's not like writing a letter. What's wrong with blowing a shofar? Right? You can blow a shofar on regular Rosh Hashanah. Right? It's not a malacha, it's not a labor heat. The itzrichla limute that would require a verse to tell me whether I could do it or not. The Tana de Beishmuel, because I learned from the house of Shmuel, kol melechet avodah lo tasu, every type of labor you're not allowed to do. This is on the festival, which includes Rosh Hashanah. Yatzta, tkiat shofar, rediat tapat. So tkiat shofar, the blowing of the shofar, and rediat tapat was a way of removing bread from an oven. Right? Which wasn't a labor that was forbidden, but it was a chachma. It was a type of, well, we'll get to in a second. Shehi chachma ve'ina malacha. It's not that it's a malacha, it's not a labor, it's a skill. Now a skill you can do on Shabbat, biblically. Right? Ela amarava midaraita mishreshari. From the Torah it was permitted to blow shofar on Shabbat. V'rabanan hu digzurbe. And the rabbis decreed that you cannot blow shofar on Shabbat. Kidraba, like Rabba Damara, Hakol Chayavin Bitkiat Shofar, everybody is obligated in blowing the shofar. Fa'in Hakol Bikin Bitkiat Shofar, but not everybody knows how to blow a shofar. Not everybody's proficient in it. Gzeira, so therefore they made a decree not to blow the shofar on Shabbat. Shema Yitlenu Biyado, V'yelech etzel habaki l'lmod. Lest he take it in his hand, and he go to somebody who's proficient, to a baki, to learn in a blow shofar. V'yavirenu arba amot b'rshut arabim. And he will then come to transgress the Shabbat by carrying 4 cubits in a public place. Okay, there are 2 ways to carry on Shabbat that is forbidden. One is if you carry from between a private and a public domain. I take something from my house and I walk it outside, right, in a certain fashion. And the other is if I'm in a public domain and I walk with something a certain distance, right? If I pick this up in a public domain and I go like this, I'm not really carrying it, right? I'm not moving it anywhere, right? But if I pick it up and I walk 4 cubits with it, right? So then, in fact, I've carried biblically. So in order that a person who might want to learn the shofar on Shabbat will go to somebody, he'll take a shofar with him to learn how to blow it, because it's a very important mitzvah, and then he'll come to carry on Shabbat. In order to avoid that, better not to blow shofar on Shabbat. Right? Yavirenu arba mot b'rshut abim, v'haynu taima de lulav, v'haynu taima de megillah, and that's why we don't use the lulav, the 4 species on Sukkot on Shabbat, and that's why we don't read megillah on Shabbat, etc. Okay? Alright, so now you haven't learned it, now we read it. Now you have an idea what it's talking about. Now what I want you to do is I want you to take 10-15 minutes and I want you to rip it apart, see what bothers you. There are questions here that should bother you. There are details here that should bother you, questions here that should bother you, questions about how this relates to Rosh Hashanah, about why these things are important, etc. So get these things straight in your head, do a little learning. While we're doing this, I'm going to give you a page which is basically the verse that is described here, the Zichron, the verse that speaks about remembering Shofar, because that's going to become important later when we learn. Okay? Any questions? Okay? Okay. Rock and roll.